make three tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah. But he did not know what to say, for they were terrified. And a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud. "This is my beloved son. Listen to him." And suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them, but Jesus only. And as they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what this rising from the dead might mean. And they asked him, "Why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come?" And he said to them, "Elijah does come first to restore all things. And how is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I tell you that Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they pleased, as it is written of him." And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, "What are you arguing about with them?" And someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." And he answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." And so reads God's word.
Good morning, everyone. Couple of things to note before I start. Number one, it's not really an outline on the back. Phil said to me, "Have you got an outline?" Not really. So I just wrote some questions. So if you're looking for me suddenly to say the questions, I may not do. Apologies for that. And while we're on the apologies front, when I go and preach somewhere, which is rare, but when I do, as in preach somewhere else, I ask, "Oh, what have you been doing recently?" And I try not to overlap. And I thought, great, I've checked with Phil, I'm not going to overlap. Don't know what I was reading. Then I find that at the end of November, Phil had preached on the Transfiguration, and it's like, oh, good, I've just chosen a similar passage. So there we go. That's a couple of admissions to failure to start off with. Hope this won't be too much of a disappointment. And it's good that we start with disappointment, actually, because that's where we're going. The title I gave the sermon is Anticlimax. Anticlimax, what is it? It is disappointment. Disappointment to the end of an exciting event. Something's been going really well and it's disappointing at the end. And we all know disappointment and disappointment like that. So you have a really good day and then it turns sour and you're disappointed. Or you have high hopes for something and they never materialise. And you feel disappointed. You're handling a difficult situation, you take a step forward, looks like it's going in the right way, and then it morphs, and suddenly you've gone two steps back. And you just feel so disappointed with it all. And disappointment, which especially occurs, let's say, after a after a great event, that's where that sense of anticlimax comes in. It felt like you were climbing something, you were going up, you were going to reach the top of something, and it just, at the end, really doesn't live up to it. You get a sense of anticlimax. You're disappointed. All the earlier excitement gives way to the ending that lets you down. It's a common experience. We all have this at some point in our lives. How do you deal with yours? When, it's all right, that's rhetorical. You don't have to shout out. Well, if you want to, you can do, I don't mind. But you can just think it in your heads if you prefer. But how do you deal with your disappointments? You know, it varies, doesn't it, with what we're like. Depends on personality type, current situation in life. Some take it in their stride. Well, just carry on anyway. Some, they're just empty. They're just sort of, an empty bag on the floor now. They don't really know what they're going to do. Some of us, we adopt that protective measure. We start early on by saying to people, oh, it's all going to go wrong. And then when it does, we go, well, I told you so. And it makes us feel better because we've handled our disappointment, so knowledgeably, because we saw it coming. The fact that we say it every time, neither here nor there. Oh, well, anyway, what I'm going to do today, I thought what I'd do today is I talk about lessons for Christians to use with disappointment when hit by anticlimax. As our reaction will vary according to who we are, according to what we're naturally like, according to our personality, according to our life situation, absolutely. But there are Christian traits we can deploy as well to deal with disappointment. And we're going to try and see some. Maybe I should answer this question before I start. Why have I chosen such a topic? Number one, I'm preaching through Mark's Gospel at Forest Baptist Church, so it's based on that. Why do extra work when you can just recycle? I mean, recycling's good, isn't it? Number two, the particular passage I have chosen from Mark's Gospel has a big sense of anticlimax in it, so it's a fitting application to think about. And number three, Christmas is over, and we're in the new year, and already your resolutions have failed. So, dealing with the anticlimactic at this moment in time, when often people get quite blue and low, middle of winter, it is sunny now, but it gets dark, etc., etc., it seems suitable to have that as a topic. Anticlimax, disappointment, how do we handle it? What can we apply into it? How I'm going to talk about it is simply to tell the story, first of all, from 9 to 19. I'm not going to talk that much about the Transfiguration itself. It's what follows that I'm interested in, from 9 to 19 in Mark chapter 9. And then secondly, to pick out some lessons from that. I'm going to leave this Bible open and hope that my Kindle sits on top of it and doesn't fall over. Okay, so Mark chapter 9, tell the story. Mark chapter 9 does begin with the Transfiguration. Hopefully you're familiar with it. Maybe you even remember just a couple of months back when Phil dealt with it. Jesus, three disciples, Peter, James and John, up a hilltop, up a mountaintop. Suddenly he changes. Doesn't look the way he looked 24 hours earlier, 2 hours earlier. Suddenly he's different. It's as though the man dressed for wandering around Galilee is suddenly dressed for heaven. As though suddenly a door flew open and he stood on the other side of it in heaven and he's completely transformed and dressed for it. It's an amazing effect. It's a stunning scene. It tells us of the glory of Jesus, the Son of God, come to us. And for a moment, the three disciples see that on display. Already, these three have believed that Jesus is God's king. That happened in an earlier chapter. Already, they believe he's the Messiah, the Christ, God's anointed king, God's chosen king, the king. But now their minds are just blown away. They are in shock, they're in awe, they're in wonder. They can't believe what he actually looks like. It's not like he just, slipped in the palace and stuck Herod's robe on. This has gone way beyond that. I apologise, my phone is beeping. I thought I'd shut it up. Hopefully it won't do too much of that. Peter, says Mark, was really overwhelmed. Peter was just like, whoosh, swept away with it. He blurts out the first thing that comes into his head. Mark actually has to sort of step in as the narrator and explain it for us. He says, he just didn't know what he was saying. There is an explanation to why he suggests putting up tents, by the way. You can ask me afterwards if you want to know what it is. But it's pretty embarrassing. You know, when you know those moments where you just come out with something because it went in your head and you couldn't stop it before it got to your mouth? Yeah, well, that was Peter. In his head, in his mouth, whoa, it's out. We've all done it. But the point is this. When we get to verse 9, which is where we're interested in the story really kicking off from, you've got three disciples, they are on a huge high. And they are probably itching to tell others what they have seen. And Jesus says to them, don't tell. Don't say what happened up here. I don't want you passing it on. I suppose at first thought we might think, oh, that's the moment of disappointment, isn't it? To have experienced that and have to be quiet. But of course, it may not have been. I mean, we're not told it was. After all, keeping a secret can actually be quite exciting. Sometimes you can get a kick out of having a secret. So that may not have been the moment of disappointment actually at all. But either way, what we are told in the passage in verse 10 is it's not actually the secrecy that they start discussing. Rather, in verse 10 it says, so they kept the matter themselves, questioning what this rising of the dead might mean. It's that they don't get. What's he going on about? Rising from the dead. He said it before, said it back in chapter 8. But they don't understand what he's going on about. It makes no sense to them. Why is he going to die at all anyway? And what's all this rising from the dead about? You end up with one of those discussions that sometimes you can get. You know, it's one of those discussions where there's a friend of yours in the group who said something a bit odd, and so sort of slightly away from him or her, you start talking about it, trying to work out what the friend means, or why they're acting so weird, or why they're speaking so weird, or, you know, so you sort of privately talk it through, and then between you, away from your friend, you come up with an explanation. It's obviously that's the reason, that's what's going on with her at the moment. And then you sort of nod to each other, but you've got to check it with your friend. So you sort of gently quiz your friend in a roundabout way to find out if you're right. You find a way to ask without putting your friend on edge. That's the disciples in verse 11. That's what they're up to. Their question is this. And they asked him, why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come? You need to know some background if you want to know why they would even say that. The question relates to an Old Testament prophet. His name's Malachi. You can read him later if you want. This prophet saw a future day. He's long before Jesus. He saw a future day of God's judgment. When Israel, the nation he was speaking to, would return to the law of Moses, what they're supposed to live by. But he also said that just before that, a prophet would arise, and the prophet would be Elijah, an even more ancient prophet, returning. And he said, this prophet, Elijah, when he comes, he's going to do something very special. He's going to reconnect different generations in Israel that have become disconnected. Fathers to children, children to fathers. He's going to reunite in a time of disunity. He's going to bring back generations. And it will be, therefore, like a national resurrection. It will be a national restoration. Israel back to her glory. And he's going to banish evil. Because there's going to be a re-embracing of the ways that God spoke through Moses. Some of the teachers of the law, the scribes in our verse, also said, well, when Malachi comes true, there's going to be also a literal resurrection. I mean, when we're talking about fathers to children, he can't just mean literally within families. This must be the ancient fathers, long dead, raised back up as well, returned to live a new life. It will be Elijah. Well, this is all in their heads. They've listened to these teachers of the law. They've heard their Malachi down at the synagogue. And they think, okay, maybe that's what's going on with Jesus. Let's probe him on it. We've just seen Moses and Elijah. Let's probe him on Malachi. Let's see if that's what's happening. I mean, they probably think, don't they? You can imagine it. They probably think that Jesus has just given Elijah some orders, something to go and do. I mean, okay, Moses and Elijah have vanished, but Jesus was talking to them, so he must have got them to do something if he's the Messiah. They're probably gone off to do whatever comes next. I mean, if Malachi's coming true, if there's going to be a great national resurrection, a great national revival, if potentially the dead are going to arise, well, they must have gone off to do something. And yet, how do they ask this of Jesus? Because when they've previously talked with him about dying and not dying and stuff like that, he's got rather sharp with them. If you do read back in the earlier chapter, you'll find that when Peter said to Jesus, "You can't die," he got a very sharp rebuke. So, you know, you're in a situation where they've heard their friend say something weird. They think they've sort of sussed out what he said, but they're very nervous about talking to him about it. How do you approach him? Well, they deploy a technique which we do use. When we want to probe something with a friend and we don't want to tread on their feet and we don't want to look stupid, what do? You say something like this. "Someone I know says," you sort of push it away from yourself slightly, don't you? "Someone I know said, what do you think?" Rather than saying, "I think," you say, "Someone I know." And that's what they do. They say to Jesus, "Why do the scribes say that Elijah first must come?" I can imagine that really what they want to say to him, "What did you just tell Elijah? What did you just say to him?" But they don't. They don't go there. They sort of step sideways and, "Oh, the lawyers talk about Elijah. Why do they do that?" Well, Jesus, of course, knows exactly what's going on. So he doesn't actually bother discussing the teachers of the law. He just goes straight in and says, "Yeah, Elijah does come first to restore things. But, and how is it written that the Son of Man, that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I tell you, Elijah has come," and they did to him whatever they pleased. He says to them this. He says, "Yeah, look, Malachi's true. Malachi's going to happen. In fact, Malachi has happened," he says. "But you're missing a huge chunk out of this. What about all the other Old Testament prophets who spoke about suffering? Why have you not included that? Why are you not thinking about that? Why do you not pay attention when I say I'm going to die? You should take that into account. How is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt?" Don't jump to the end of the story and the big resurrection. Let's deal with the other steps too, he says. Notice that he says to them in verse 13, "I tell you." Solemn statement, isn't it? "I tell you. Will you please forget the teachers of the law? Let's not discuss your mate who says. Listen to me." Remember, these three guys have just stood on a mountaintop where God has said, "This is my son, listen to him." And then on the way down the mountain, they go, "Oh, we've been listening to the teachers of the law." And they say, yeah. Jesus says, "Listen to me. Elijah has come, but he suffered, because suffering is the pattern before resurrection." Who does he mean? Who is Elijah who's come? He doesn't mean the literal Elijah. There's not been a literal resurrection. Elijah is wherever Elijah is. But He means John the Baptist. Back in Mark chapter 6, John the Baptist appeared, one of Jesus' relatives. He was killed by a local warlord. John the Baptist fulfilled the role of Elijah. He was Malachi embodied, Malachi coming true. But it didn't play out as the disciples were hoping. And that's why they didn't see it. Yeah, they didn't go to Jesus, did they, and say, we've been thinking about Malachi. Was it John? No, they're utterly confused. It's Jesus who has to correct them because they weren't expecting suffering, because they never expect suffering. Even though Jesus says, I must die, they're all going, no, it doesn't work that way. They're looking for resurrection. Jesus says, yeah, after death. That's how resurrection works. It's not a complicated idea. You die, then you get resurrected. But they can't process it because they don't expect the suffering. They don't think that you can win victory by passing into pain, by having opposition, and then being killed. Jesus has said he will, and that will be the defeat of his enemies. But they can't see it. They can't process it. Suffering lies ahead for him and them, as it did for John the Baptist, and yet they can't see it. They want to believe in sort of a simple, powerful victory of God coming to win the day, sweeping in from heaven, opening the door, sending Moses, sending Elijah. Hey, send a host of angels, sort it all out. Not going to happen, says Jesus. We will win by the cross where I'll die, like the death of John the Baptist, like some of you will suffer and die. You know the three guys on the mountaintop? James. James will have had thorough training with Jesus as an apostle and then have his head cut off very soon. Peter, as far as we know, will be able to serve for a few more years and then they'll crucify him upside down, as far as we know from history. Only John will get to live a reasonably long life. God works through the suffering, through the death. They can't see it yet. But Jesus is trying to get them to see it. God works his strength in the weakness of his people. His disciples, therefore, are sort of right. They can see Malachi in this, and they're just painfully wrong. Now, I told you the story, and what I want you to do, in a sense, is try just now to put yourself inside the heads of these guys so that you can feel for them. Not just how they're processing it intellectually or whatever, but just feel for them emotionally. Feel for where they're at. A few minutes earlier, they were literally on top of the world. I mean, one, they were up a mountain. Two, they were looking into heaven through an open door. And three, they thought everything was possible. They were on an absolute high. The glory of the Lord, the resurrection of Moses and Elijah, the coming true of prophecy. And now they're walking back down the mountain, and nothing much seems to have changed. Jesus looks ordinary. Moses and Elijah have gone. Apparently they haven't gone anywhere to do anything. And Jesus is going on about dying again. Goodness, that's depressing. They have gone from the high, and they are crashing down as they walk down. Still, these things can't get worse, can they? Oh, yes, of course they can. Verse 14. And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. The group arrive at the bottom of the mountain and they arrive in a shouting match. For any of you who have read Exodus, this will have echoes for you when Moses descended from the mountain. There's a shouting match between the disciples and the teachers of the law, the scribes. I tried to envision, you know, what does it feel like for these guys to arrive at this moment? It struck me that, you know, I don't know, maybe whether you ever get this, I don't know, but sometimes you can get those moments if you're in a church somewhere and you spend an hour together, you're worshipping the Lord, you've sung some songs that have moved your heart, you've heard something read that's really touched you, somebody's prayed and it's like they've spoken on your behalf, somebody's preached and it's like they spoke to you. And the service ends with an amen, and you sit there quietly for a moment, you pray, and you open your eyes, and you go and get a coffee and you start chatting with people, and 5 minutes after the service over, you realise you're in a conversation where somebody's whinging about another Christian or arguing with somebody. Like, whoa, that changed fast. And it's such a letdown. Must have felt like that for these guys, mustn't it? Well, certainly here anyway. Now, what do the crowd do? Well, they're amazed. Jesus is back. And they cheerfully go over to greet him instead of feeling utterly ashamed of themselves, as they should do. Jesus asks, verse 16, what are you arguing about with them? And someone from the crowd answered him, teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able. He's got a son, he's got epilepsy, something similar, prone to seizures, lose control, the crowd blame an unclean spirit, there's abusing him, and they just end up in an argument all about it. Because your 9 disciples couldn't help me. Your guys couldn't do anything. I came to you for help. You can imagine the teachers of the law are thoroughly loving it. I mean, you know, they're Jesus' opponents. I mean, they must have absolutely loved it to mock the failure of this team. You brought him the heir. That really went great, didn't it? They could really help you. So the argument is going on. But how does Jesus react to it all? Oh, faithless generation. How long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me. I quite like to think of Jesus sighing at this moment. That seems to me a natural thing to do, shaking his head. You just don't believe, do you? And he doesn't separate out. He doesn't just look at the teachers of the law or the crowd, you know, and ignore the 9 disciples. He's just looking at them all. Oh, you just don't believe, do you? Why does he say that? Because what he sees is this, that the disciples, and indeed the crowd who have thronged to see it all happen, they've tried to handle the demon in their own strength. They've not tried trusting in the strength of the Lord. They're trusting in themselves. The same problem is on display at the base of the mountain as he has seen displayed over and over again. That the disciples do not simply trust in the power of God as exhibited through Jesus Christ. They keep trying to do it in their own strength. They thought they could fix this. They thought they could deal with this. And they couldn't. And then their enemies mock them for it. And they all end up in a big tiff about it. It comes back to the same problem. When Jesus says, now I must die, they're going, no, that can't work. But my Father will raise me on the third day. No, it's not like that. That's an impossible option. If you're not around, we can't succeed. You know, you don't trust, do you, he says. You are faithless. You don't believe in the power of God at work here. You try to do it not in faith, but by sight. And what happened with the boy proved it. Jesus is away and they all fail. Because they don't live by faith. They don't believe. That's why Jesus says, you know, how long do I need to stay? You can feel the exasperation in his voice. You know, how? I have to go soon. You remember the bit I said about dying? And what are you lot going to do? You're all just going to fall apart, aren't you? You're not going to cope. The moment I've gone, you're all going to collapse in unbelief because I'm not here. I go up a mountain and you get into an argument. What are you going to do if I'm in a grave for 3 days? What are you going to do if I ascend back to my Father? All fall apart? There's such a sense of disappointment in the whole story, isn't there? You go from the heights of the Transfiguration to a bunch of bickering people on the bottom of a hill and the Lord Jesus saying, if I leave, what will happen? Such an anticlimax. Now, that's where I'm going to leave you. That's nice, isn't it? I'm going to leave you at that moment. I'm not going to tell any more of the story. You have to go away and read it for yourselves and find out what happens next. Because I want you just to sit in that moment, feel the sense of disappointment descending from glory to the mess in the valley. And then I want to give you some applications that I hope come out from it that help us to think about how do we cope with such situations? What do we do with disappointment? Anticlimax. Lesson number one then, four lessons. Lesson number one, expect it first of all. Expect to be disappointed. Expect your life to hit these moments. Now, that does not mean Christians function like the pessimists I described at the start. Some of us who are pessimistic by character do the old, it will all go wrong, so that we can say, I told you so, later on. Not that type of expectation. But you should have the expectation of being a Bible realist if you're a Christian. Jesus said over, over, over again, the road to victory, the road to God's glory, the road to great blessing lies through suffering, lies through a cross, lies through carrying a cross. He said earlier on in Mark's gospel to his disciples, I must go to a cross, you must carry a cross every day. Expect. Oh, goodness, this silly phone. I'm sure I'd shut this thing up. I apologise. Let's try again. Expect to be disappointed in the middle of sermons. The man's preaching away. You're trying to listen to him and his phone's going off all the time. No, I don't think Jesus said that. I'm saying that. But he did say, this is the shape of the Christian life. It will hurt. It is normal. It is normal for Christians to feel disappointed and to meet anticlimax in their lives where they thought everything was going to go well and then it didn't. And most often, you will find it in situations with other people. Like here. Not just in the, oh, I was building that wonderful thing for my house and then all the glue parts fell apart. Or, I had this great career mapped out and then it sort of crashed 10 years down the line because I was unwell. But actually often with other people. Like the disciples, like Jesus here. Just as we're feeling good, someone pours cold water over us. Expect that because we carry a cross. It's a life of suffering. Then number two, don't lose heart. The fact that you're disappointed doesn't mean you've suddenly wandered off the road where Christians walk and have ended up somewhere else. You're on the road where Christians walk. So pray for perseverance. In other words, don't become miserable. I know, again, some of us are different. Some of us are more prone to misery than others. I get that. That's just character. Fair enough. But as much as you can, battle with it. Don't become miserable. Don't become bitter. Don't become angry. And don't become hopeless. One of the key lessons of the New Testament, that Christians are people who believe that this life will bring suffering and rejoice. Okay, so it's a completely bonkers idea, isn't it? Really stupid. Yet it's true. Christians believe that we will walk a life where there's suffering and we will find joy. Ultimately and en route. Christian is somebody who prays and asks the Lord to help him, her, keep going through the hits as the Lord himself said. Jesus sort of expounds on this in chapter 8 of Mark, if you want to read that later on as well. He says about, you know, if you try to save your life, if you try to escape the hard trials and get the good life now, well, you might find it. But you'll end up with dust in your hand. You'll end up with nothing, because if you try to save your soul, you end up with nothing. Because everything this world can give is always temporary. You lose it in the end. But he said, but if you accept the deadly path I'm laying out, with all its struggle, you will find it leads up and up to wonder and glory. You receive life. So pray for perseverance. Don't give way to the disappointment. When you are disappointed, let it be the trigger for you to pray for determination and strength to persevere. And when you meet a fellow believer who is disappointed, and pray for them to persevere through it and to press on and to find determination and grace. Pray for one another. One of the greatest things that helps disappointment is that you know other people feel for you in it. Okay, sometimes it can be a wind-up, can't it? People say, oh, I know how you feel. You think, no, you've no idea. I don't mean like that. But nonetheless, knowing people are concerned for you, pray for you, ask about how that is to persevere, helps you to persevere. But if you're going to pray that way, third application, third idea, you've got to believe. This was the problem with the disciples, it was the problems with the crowd, unbelief. When life turned hard, they threw their hands in the air, they forgot God because suddenly he wasn't ruling the universe anymore, and they ended up in arguments. Yeah, why did the 9 disciples not suddenly announce, you know, right, okay, we failed. So teachers of the law, you go and stand over there somewhere because we're going to be on our knees praying until God does something about this. Oh, no, they don't do that. They just end up in a shouting match. Because it's what we do. Oh, it's all failed. What can I do? Don't be like that. When life gets hard, we must work on our belief. Fill our minds with everything the Lord has done for us. Fill our hearts with all the things the Lord is going to do for us. Glory lies ahead. We endure by growing in faith. Do you know, Christians aren't called to be tough. If by that we think it means we become tough, we become hard, nothing touches me and I can do it. Christians are called to be faithful. Remember Jesus said, faithless generation. Christians are called to be faithful. We trust the Lord's strength. And he brings us through. Disappointment is your great chance to practice belief in the Lord and prove him true, that he will bring you through. It is a tremendous opportunity. Turn the disappointments into prayer for belief, for faith. And what helps with that? One last point, with this we'll wrap up. Don't let the bad moments steal your encouragements. The 3 disciples did see the glory of the Lord at the top of the mountain. The mess at the bottom of the mountain did not cancel that out. But we do this. It's like it's programmed into our brains as they now exist. Maybe it's to do with the chapter that Andrew was reading to us earlier. I have a good day. Wow, everything goes really well. I get some great work done. I have some good conversations with some people. I spend a lovely lunch break. And then, at about 7 o'clock, I have a nightmare of an hour with some horrible problem. 9 o'clock, somebody says to me, my wife says to me, how's your day? Rubbish. No, it wasn't. That's a lie. My day was majority good. I just had a nasty hour. But the way the human mind now works is to fall into sin is you can have sort of, you know, 100 great things and the one bad thing will just like, bang, that's it. Everything else is wiped out. It's like a seesaw. Bad things weigh heavily on our minds. And we need a huge number of good things often to outweigh them. As Christians, we try not to play that game because we believe in truth. We believe in seeing things truly as they are. We value the blessings the Lord gives. You know, if the Lord gave you 8 hours of blessing and then said to you, I'd like you to put up with a really nasty hour now, okay? We don't go,
So that's it. That's it. Everything was rubbish.
The baby has slept beautifully for most of this service. No one is to think that baby was crying the whole way through and disturbing the sermon. You see, that baby was chosen by the Lord to give a living demonstration of the application to stick in your heads when you go home. It's far from easy, but we value every blessing and we see the truth. And this is the path of faith. We believe we are walking through life with the Lord. We believe he wins in the end. He gives joy on the way and we grab those joys. So let's hold on to these things. Are you going to get disappointed? Yes. That's the road we're on. So pray for perseverance, to keep on going and not just fall into bitterness or anger. Pray for belief, to fill your minds with the Lord's strength rather than keep looking at your own. And don't let the bad things steal the encouragements and the joys that God gives to you. Amen.